Guru Nation, welcome to episode 340 of Random Musings from the Clinical Trials Guru. In this episode, I interview Zachary Gopst, CEO and founder of LeapCure. LeapCure is a modern version of a patient recruitment company. They're very forward-thinking, as you'll soon see from this interview with Zach. They focus on advocacy as well as influencer market, and I'm really interested in the influencer market because I think that influencers are going to influence, for lack of a better word, clinical research recruitment. At least I think it's a huge possibility. And then we talk about how that ties into virtual trials, and we also backtrack to how he got started as a founder of a tech company. So with all that being said, I really hope you enjoy this interview. Just to take care of some housekeeping, you know our CRA Academy, thecraacademy.com, $4,000 3-month program, oncology internship. It's amazing. The CRC Academy starts March 1st, 3-month program online, also have an internship. Also amazing. We had our first inaugural class. It went really well. Everyone's so happy. The book, Comprehensive Guide to Clinical Research, doing well, guys. Thank you. Thanks to you, it's doing well. Keep spreading the word. If you haven't gotten a chance to check it out, The Comprehensive Guide to Clinical Research, it's on Amazon in paperback, Kindle, and audio format. Audio, no surprise here, is my favorite. My Patreon channel, patreon.com/dansfera. $5 a month, I talk about business, entrepreneurship, digital marketing, etc. Finally, our client services. We help, did you know we help sites get studies, negotiate budgets, do their source docs, SOPs, help them with whatever it is they may be, whether you're a startup site or an established site, you want to outsource these things and still continue to do it yourself, but it's nice to have somebody in your corner doing this for you without you having to worry about it. $1,299 a month, month to month. There will never be another fee. Glad we got that all out of the way so you can enjoy this interview. Let me know what you think. Text me right now that you're listening, 949-415-6256. And since you're going to be texting, also text 31996 and text the word guru to 31996. Thank you. Hello, Guru Nation. Welcome to another episode of Random Musings from the Clinical Trials Guru. I'm Dan Sfera. I'm interviewing Zachary Gopst, founder of LeapCure, as you can see behind him. Where are you? You're in LeapCure's workspace headquarters?
Yeah, our Oakland, or actually San Francisco office. So up in the Bay Area today. But happy to be with you, and appreciate the time.
Zach, let's start by talking about LeapCure, but then I want to go back and talk about your origin story and then wrapping it up with LeapCure and the future. So what, for those that don't know, what can you tell us what LeapCure is?
Yeah, sure. LeapCure is an advocacy-based patient awareness and recruitment company for clinical trials. And so what we do is, for any indication, you know, under the sun, we'll break down how do we get as much advocacy engaged into a clinical trial as possible, not just your large foundations and charities, everyone down to, you know, bloggers, health influencers, and grassroots advocacy organizations. And so we've been at it for about 5 years. And yeah, we combine like the human component of advocacy partnerships with a platform that kind of make sure that the workflow is all working to make sure that both patients and sites are having a good experience.
Wow. Yeah. You know what? I did an interview earlier today, and I was talking to the founder of a CRO, and towards the end, we started talking virtual trials and patient influencers, right? And I mean, what a perfect interview to do after that interview, because I can ask all the follow-up questions of where we left off. Because I do think that's the future, you know, advocacy, like grassroots. You know, when I started my clinics in 05, I ran out of ideas for where to recruit patients. So I started going to support groups for patients. And I would just sit quietly, you know, engage. And then at the end, they ask you, well, what's your, you know, do you have, how do you struggle with this? And I said, no, I actually, you know, thankfully I don't, but I have a research study. And, you know, and then I like educated them. And sometimes people, like the moderators, get upset, but usually they were like really happy that somebody came from industry.
So that was like my venture into that, but what you're doing essentially is like scaling this somehow. And now that it's 2020, you know, we got influencers for everything. So patient influencers, is there a patient influencer for every indication?
Just about. So you'll have a lot of rare indications that are more general, but you know, the way the influencer markets work in the consumer setting is they help you find very niche groups that, you know, are very devoted to some sort of cause or personality. And similarly, you know, influencers work that way in the health sphere around health advocates. And so, you know, we work on some of the toughest studies that you'll find in the world, because our advocacy-based approach is usually one of the few ways that you can find those patients. In most cases, you know, the influencer market will kind of work in between, where in some cases you want to go advocacy, in some cases you want to go influencer, particularly things that are more prevalent. When things are more prevalent, your influencer communities are going to be a little bit more engaged than your typical digital ads. So, yeah, it's
really
it's everything under the sun.
So when something's more prevalent, the influencers... That's interesting. I would have guessed the opposite. Like, for the orphan diseases, you would have had, like, micro-celebrity influencers, right?
You have that, too. But there's only so many out there. You're usually working with subsets of advocacy, with very rare. And you're kind of speculatively going after the influencers, versus if you're working with something much more prevalent, that's where the influencers will make a huge difference in terms of, you know, how many patients you're getting in front of until you get an enrollment. And with each site, you kind of have a point in time where you're going to burn out the site before they stop working with your firm. Hmm. And so you're working with influencers, you're able to make sure that the patient quality is better from the beginning, they enroll faster, and the engagement levels that you see from the site, you know, perpetuate in a strong fashion between both your ads and advocacy.
It's such a smart idea. I mean, how long have you guys been doing the influencer thing?
So informally, you know, we're pushing it right now because we're seeing more and more of an appetite to hearing it. But since the beginning of our company, we've been working with, like, we've done studies for female health and use, like, parent bloggers. And in a way, we've been using influencers since the beginning of the company. But it's become about 50% of our outreach now versus...
Wow.
From the beginning.
And that's going to only increase, right? Like, you predict in the next decade it's going to be 100 at one point.
It's a very fast-growing market. It's just because, you know, we're living in a world where influencer is a career. It's a profession. It's a way that people are able to kind of hone their craft and focus on to, you know, make themselves money. And so, yeah, we're seeing that it's getting bigger and bigger. And the difference with influencers versus advocacy groups is influencers are really dialed into the behaviors that they're following. It really makes or breaks them. And so that's a big part of the reason why that group is growing.
Oh, so interesting. I mean, yeah, this is, it's so easy to, it's easy and difficult to do a paradigm changing company in research, because research is usually so behind other industries that you can just look at other industries and see what they're doing, right? But it's also difficult because, like, not that much information about it, and you know, a lot of old-fashioned thinking still. So what have you, like, who's your customer? Would be the pharma companies, or do you work with sites?
It's a little bit all of the above. I'd say number one, pharma, number two through the CROs, and number three with sites. And so we'll work in different ways depending on the phase of the research and depending on the budgets. You know, it's going to vary. And there are times where we're like, hey, you know, this makes sense to put all of our resources into it. And there are times where it's like, you know, we'll help you launch a couple campaigns, show you how to do it yourself, depending on the situation. So,
wow.
But most of our work is direct to sponsors.
I have a lot of questions about LeapCure. We'll get back into it. But I wanted to get, like, I'm curious of your origin story. How does somebody do this? I mean, you know, how did you decide you're going to do this kind of stuff for patient recruitment?
Yeah, I don't know, to be honest, but my path was I had come from was very analytically minded growing up. I did management consulting, and a startup in LA brought me in to help with some of the first mobile and virtual clinical trials that were being done for the startup in LA. From that experience, I just kind of fell in love with the space and kind of dug in more and more and more, was exposed to how advocacy can improve research. And it was kind of a scratch that I felt like itching, and that led us to founding LeapCure, going on, actually, our birthday is February 29th, so we'll be 1 year old from when we launched the product.
Okay, so you're a new company.
Well, sorry, it's been 4 years in terms of the amount of days, but leap day to leap day, it's been...
I got you. You confused me, man. Leap year joke, I get it. That's 4 years, I get it. It went over my head. Yeah, because I was about to say, I thought I saw you guys at conferences like at least a couple years ago, so...
Yeah.
Okay. So, you were consulting for a startup in LA that was doing virtual trials. Tech side, or what?
So I was actually full time there. I was helping manage their operation. So they had like hired from the outside and kind of taught me the space. So I was fortunate enough to kind of see it from the inside and see it from the perspective of someone running research before we became a service provider.
Gotcha. And I imagine while you were there, you got to see the pain points of the industry. And that's when you looked at this recruitment thing and you say, hey, you know, 90% of all studies are behind on recruitment. I mean, what opportunity, right?
Exactly. And we saw that, you know, our options to scale were very limited. You know, no one was really taking an advocacy-based approach that was cost-effective and made sense. You know, a lot of the options were traditional media and a lot of human capital that went into the resourcing. And so, we saw an opportunity to kind of fix what could help like move the drug development lifecycle forward, you know, not just be a good business, but help a lot of people that are kind of on the outside. And in the case of advocacy, these are people that have the most at stake. These are voices of people that, you know, are dissatisfied with standard of care, are organizing, trying to do anything they can to kind of improve their quality of life. And so giving them a voice was something that was very easy for us to decide to champion.
And prior to you working for this virtual trial, your background is software engineer?
So I've done management consulting for tech companies up in the Bay Area. And okay. So, you know, finance and analytical mindset, helping scale. It was a combination of hardware and software work that I was doing. And so, didn't know that it would apply to this space. I use a lot of what I learned there, surprisingly. And like, you know, how you gather data, present data, a lot of those fundamentals, you know, they're very applicable in this space. And it gave me an outside perspective, which I think helps because in a lot of cases in our industry, people will kind of have an attitude like, you know, this is not how it works. It has to work like this. I have some reference points about how I can make things work. And so I'm very fortunate that coming from an outside perspective, I'm able to kind of be dangerous in this space.
Yeah, I just interviewed someone recently on that too. He came from the hospitality space, and now he's starting a site network, and he's trying to emulate the customer service from what he's successfully done in the hospitality to clinical research. I told him, good luck with that, but you know, he's going to try. Not to make this too much of a business episode, because this is clinical research, but can't help it because I'm an entrepreneur as well, and your story's related to this. So there must have been something when you were working for the virtual trial company.
Yeah.
Did you just bootstrap this, or did you raise funding first? How did you actually start?
Yeah. Our zero to this. I think people just liked us. I don't know. I mean, we had a passion for what we were doing from day one. We knew that we could make an impact from what we were doing previously. What I did was, you know, I left that previous company. I took a back office restaurant job. I did that for like 30, 40 hours a week. And then at night, I put 40, 50 hours into the business. And then when we won our first few deals, I went all in and, you know.
Wow.
Tried to raise some money, 500 startups let us in, and kind of just built momentum did a lot of creating our own luck, though. But yeah, it was our origin story was a lot of not getting paid in the early stages, and it really taught us this was you can't do that for every project. You really have to be passionate about what you're doing. You have to have what we call founder problem fit. You have to really care about solving the problem in front of you. And so, Fortunately, things fell into place for me. And yeah, 4 years later, I'm still at it. So,
good for you guys, man. Yeah. So, and hats off to you for doing that. That's a really good thing. And hopefully we see that it's going to be helping improve recruitment and retention. I mean, with advocacy, can you explain the difference or just explain what advocacy actually means?
Yeah. So advocacy, these are generally communities, sometimes organized by foundations that have different causes. In many cases, they're nonprofits. And patients look to these groups. The use case for us that's typical is to find out about, either ways to cope with their condition or find new alternative treatments or just find some way to improve their quality of life. And typically, they've bought into these advocacy groups. They're participating in events, engaging with their materials. And for the purpose of, participating in clinical trials, these are people that really know their stuff before you're throwing them in front of the site. They know, what's going on with their condition. They understand what are the clinical trials are available, what standard of care is available. And so when you send them to a specific study, there's not as much need to go from beginning to end explaining what the study is to try to get people to be more interested. The interest level is there. The fit is usually there. It's incredible how good of a fit advocacy is for research. We kind of, just found it. However, it's not something that we've worked incredibly hard to try to cultivate. We look at advocacy as kind of the barometer for how you find a patient that's engaged to join a clinical trial and try to replicate it. But yeah, with advocacy, you're working with, people that in general have pre-qualified themselves to try to find your clinical trial, know that where we're trying to take them is where they want to go.
Is this, remember, I don't know if you remember, but back in the 2010, I think that's when I joined Twitter, 2010, 2011, there was this whole e-patient movement.
Yeah.
Is that still around? I haven't really heard much about that.
It's not something we work with, in terms of e-patient. I think in a way it's a little bit of an outdated way of thinking of a patient to me.
Yeah.
I think registries have a good purpose, but I think sometimes there's the thought that just because you can reach this many people and get that data, that you've actually got the problem solved. In a lot of cases, that data is old. Clinical trials require specific condition levels, specific medications that people are on. That stuff changes. And level of interest changes over time, too. Mm. And so when you're talking about, a patient that might have been in a database at some point, that's really tough to count on because, to the point we were discussing before we jumped on the call, you only have so many patients you can send to the sites before, they're going to stop if a patient's not enrolling. And so that the e-patient registry concept, you really have to be very careful with. And in some cases, you're stuck with it, particularly for very rare diseases. And we'll utilize it from time to time. But it's kind of a complementary effort and something that you probably don't want to start with until you already have the right engagement from your patients and your sites.
Interesting. So I guess the influencers now, bringing us to the patient influencers, there's just about an influencer now for every vertical in healthcare?
Yeah, pretty much. And it gets very detailed as well. And it's important to know when to go to advocacy and when to go to influencers.
Yeah, how do you know when to go? Like you mentioned earlier a little bit about that. How do you know?
Yeah, you really, so as a part of the recruitment process, you really have to look under the hood. So the way that we will usually launch our advocacy campaigns, it starts with an informational interview where we understand the details of the study and at LeadCure, we're never just looking at the synopsis. We really dive into, what are the procedures that have to be endured? We have to dive in from a clinical perspective of what standard of care. and what other clinical trials are out there so that we know this is the right group to get engaged. And then we want to know their reach. We want to know, you know, if they are looking for specific types of research. And then we'll try to launch a test launch in their best channel and then kind of replicate what works. And so, you know, sometimes influencers kind of know their communities dead on and can give you that. Sometimes it's a guess. And so we kind of prioritize our launches according to where do we have a good level of certainty versus not. And influencers tend to be, you know, across the board. There's a lot of variation. Some, you know, will cover the very rare diseases and know their stuff. Some, it's a crapshoot, but they're willing to work with you because they believe in your cause. It's really a cool process, but yeah, there's a lot of behind the scenes work that goes into before you launch with an advocacy group or an influencer.
Interesting. Yeah, and wouldn't, like, I would imagine the influencers would be very protective of their brand. So it's not like they would just accept any trial, right? You have to have a right trial for them.
Yeah, and us too. At LeapCure as a company, you know, we've turned down studies that we don't think improve human quality of life.
So it starts with you. It starts with you then, and that end.
Yeah, if we don't think it's going to work for our advocacy community, to your point, like, why are we getting involved? Like, for us, yeah, I think it's a part of it as well. Now, there are really challenging studies that we'll take on where the procedures are really tough, and with rare conditions where there's not a lot of, you know, ways to measure condition progression, you'll sometimes send patients through a lot of visits, and it can be quite cumbersome. But we'll try to make sure that the recruitment process educates the sponsors in terms of, you know, you're restricting this level of interest because your protocol looks like this. So yeah, it's something that we look at on behalf of advocacy. And, it, you know, we'll also see there are studies we take on where advocacy says no, but ideally we can, you know, get in front of it before we have to start recruiting.
And this is amazing. So what's the size of the organization? How many employees? Who do you tend to hire?
Yeah, we run pretty lean. So we're 4 full-time and about 8 advisors spanning clinical operations, sales, marketing. And so we're pretty close. We have to communicate through a lot. Clinical trials are not easy. The amount of communication that has to happen to make things successful is pretty high. But we are always looking for contributors, people to kind of start on the side. If we're not looking for a full-time hire, you know, we'll look at people on contract when that goes well, you know, kind of ramp up. And as we see that they're a good fit for the organization full-time, we'll bring them on. So we usually make 2 or 3 hires a year, and whether, you know, our needs are on the engineering end or on, you know, the partnership end, following up with patients and sites, we call it patient success, or business development, helping us, you know, break into different parts of pharma. You know, opportunities come up, and we're always open to the conversation.
Yeah, that's interesting. So as far as like these advocacy groups, you would basically, like, because it's an educational process to explain. I remember from when I used to go to support groups, like, I had to spend 20 minutes explaining just the beginnings of what clinical research is, even before I talk about the study I have. Yeah. So like who does the educating to the community on your behalf, or is it like scalable through technology?
No, that's what the job. Well, the initial partnership is an education process.
Okay.
Once you know what it's like, then, you know, we'll go back to them and they kind of know the song and dance. And the initial stage, we see that in the U.S., you know, partners and influencers kind of get it. The education process when we're doing global studies, when we're working in different parts of Europe or elsewhere, that's where, you know, we have to go through a lot of like meetings just to educate on, you know, how partnership marketing works and, you know, what's going to happen with the patients. We have to get board approvals. And so it's like what you did with those support groups. But it's what, you know, it's what our recruitment lead does all day. So there's some economies of scale, and your job is to build these partnerships. You've worked with, you know, 4,000 of them already. You know what to do the next time. So it's there's a part of what we do that is not as focused on scalability. It's that really human person-to-person piece where, you know, we're trying to make sure that we're working with the right partner and getting, you know, the right people into a clinical trial. I don't think every problem is solved by technology. The technology piece comes in for us where we're trying to listen to what the patient groups are telling us, we're trying to listen to what the sites are telling us, and we're trying to communicate to the study teams, this is where we are, this is where we need to go next. That's really where most of our technology helps us, but that education piece requires a bit of a human touch and adaptability because, yeah, it's a global game, and different people are at different stages of the process when we first engage them.
So ideally, you would need, like, former coordinators. I don't know about if CRAs would do this, but, like, somebody who's worked at a site and understands research and also worked with the patients, I'm guessing.
Yeah, So on our patient success team that works in between onboarding the sites to use our portal where the patients go when they sign up, and the patients, helping guide them through that process, that background is immensely helpful. Mm-hmm. And so we have, you know, people on staff, but also advisors with that background that can help us understand, you know, if a site's telling us this, what's going on behind the scenes? Like, what are they busy with? Is it related to the protocol? Is it related to, you know, the provider that they're working for? Whatever it might be. So we do have to play that role of almost a clinical enrollment manager. We don't go in as much detail as some specialized companies. But, you know, if we want to make sure that the right patients are getting to the right places, we have to do that work.
Yeah, you know, that's the most challenging part, because I've talked to other... I mean, you guys don't really consider yourself a recruitment company, but you kind of are, like a patient recruitment company, yeah. Right? So, like, there's other ones that I've talked to, and their biggest challenge, I was actually on a panel at DIA with one of these guys, and they're right. They said their biggest challenge, even they can be doing a great job of getting these leads, but if the sites don't call them, you know, they're not going to get screened. And so that becomes, I would imagine for you guys, a huge challenge as well.
Yeah. No. So we're from where we started the company to where we are now, that challenge has really transformed what we do, because it used to be named like, here's your budget, go get as many good quality patients as possible near these sites. That's actually not how you do recruitment. You need to figure out, how do you cultivate the right site, you know, profile, you know, engagement profile, in terms of, you know, we're going to send them a patient, we know that they're going to look at it, we know that they're going to move to a certain step of conversion, and then we want to funnel in traffic according to where we think they can handle it from a capacity and trust perspective. And so it's not about, you know, hitting a referral cap. It's better to have less referrals and not be as efficient with your budget, but to send the right patients to the right sites at the right time. And so, yeah, there's a lot. So advocacy helps, because when you start with advocacy, you're getting that profile in a good spot. But yeah, there's a lot of nuance to making sure you get that right. And yeah, at the beginning, you know, our company first thought of it as like, hey, this isn't our fault. Like, someone else has to fix this. We got to the point where if we're going to solve the problem we're trying to solve, we've got to fix it. So
you're smart. Smart, because working at a site, I mean, I don't do this anymore, but when I was the coordinator, you know, we would get these vendors, you probably know who they are, and they would send us leads. And then, you know, when it started, I was like, cool, this is awesome. I get free patients. So I started calling, numbers not working, patient slams the phone, not interested. How'd you get my number? By the time you do like six of these in a row, you're like, screw this. You know, I can like go make a coffee and I'm okay.
Yeah. And these coordinators are busy. They're taking time out of the day to run clinical trials in most cases. Their day-to-day is something entirely different. Their day-to-day is, I make three phone calls, I reach three people, I help three people. It's not, you know, they're not used to being telemarketers calling 100 people, one that's interested. They're not in a sales role. They weren't hired to be salespeople. And so to have them data mine and then do telesales, it doesn't make sense.
Just giving us, and like when I was doing this, it was giving us more work, and for things that wouldn't lead to anything. Maybe one out of 20 came for a screening, but to me that wasn't good ROI. And you're not guaranteed a randomization, but the sponsors would call you and say, hey, these guys sent the list, you haven't replied to any of them, now all of a sudden I have more work to do, and for what, you know? So I think the model you have is smart. I think that's the way to go, and I think that's how you get the site buy-in.
Well, our data says it too. So, like, we're seeing, you know, site engagement from when we started the company. We were dragging sites to log into our portal once every week or two. And now we've got...
I would have hated you.
Yeah. And and rightfully so. To an extent, like, our patient quality is always good. I think a lot of these sites have been burned by other firms. Mm-hmm. They log into a portal, they can't tell the difference.
So now you're paying for the sins of the forefathers.
Every day. But we're also seeing that sites are starting to use us. We're getting like an average of like one update per day from our engaged sites right now. And so they're getting that level of value because we've kind of adjusted to understand, you know, how do you send a patient to a site? It's not just like give them a list. Like, there's a certain way and there's certain signals from them that you need to see before you kind of ramp up that volume.
Right. Yeah. Very smart. Now we'll come full circle. So as we wrap up virtual trials, because that's kind of how the story started.
Yeah.
And that's where the story is headed. I mean, the industry is headed in that direction. I don't think it will be at the expense of traditional studies. I think it's just going to increase the number of studies we have. But they're relying, I mean, for virtual trials to work, they're relying on people like you, companies like you, and no longer physicians and their own databases. They're relying on you guys, right?
Yeah. And it works incredibly well. Advocacy complements virtual very well, because when you're running virtual, the variable that's most influential is the engagement of the patient. We don't have all these workflow challenges that we have trying to get sites to be available. You usually have a centralized person that's used to some sort of conversion funnel, and you can work on that. And so when you're combining virtual with advocacy, we're in a very good place, and my previous company is very good at that. You know, where things go virtually, I think it's to your point. There are going to be some studies that are, you know, fully virtual, some where there's a virtual component to kind of either drive engagement or to help because a certain site visit shouldn't be as cumbersome. And we're looking forward to seeing it change. We're sticking to our space with recruitment. We're not becoming a virtual CRO in any way. But we fully encourage it, because we know from the patient data that we're getting that it does make a difference in terms of getting the most engaged patients involved. So,
are you guys building as you go, and as the months turn into years, are you guys keeping a database as well?
Kind of. I'd say that, you know, similar to the e-patient challenge of patient profiles change. And also, patients are looking to us to solve a problem. They're not looking for us to repurpose their data. We want to be right by the patients. And so if they've signed up for a clinical trial, we find another one that's out there for them. We'll see if they're interested. We don't spam them. Mm-hmm. And most of the value we're going to provide are finding patients raising their hands today with new outreach.
Gotcha. But
the previous data is very helpful in terms of informing, how does this need to work with this indication? What signals are we getting from the people who are going to enroll? That stuff kind of stays the same. But we're not big on the database model. I think that partly for ethical reasons, but also from an operations perspective, it's not the best source of finding people who are interested today in joining a clinical trial.
Good point. Because with virtual trials, you know, it seems like everybody's in a race to acquire a database. But to your point, it's only as good as like how recently you can refresh it, and it could be accurate, right?
Yeah, you can do it, but most infrastructure isn't designed for that. If you're still sending patients to a research site and a coordinator, you know, if a coordinator is good at data mining and being a telemarketer, then yes, the database tactic can work. Usually, there's such an investment on the patient side that approach is not best. You want someone who can empathize, you want someone who can understand someone's health profile and guide them personally. And so, yeah, for us it's a little bit of a mismatch to just build up a database. But it's good to kind of take the insights and the know-how so that when you have a new study, you know how to manage expectations and get in front of the right people. I think that's the most important piece of data that we're capturing when we recruit, is to make sure that those learnings, you know, fall over into the next studies.
And what's your biggest challenge now when getting a new client, like a new pharma or biotech, you know, who've been burned in the past by recruitment vendors that promise everything but really, you know, don't deliver much? So, like, what I imagine you've encountered a lot of that. So, what is your, like, how do you tell them that you're different?
Yeah, there's two things. One is the, you know, clinical development folk can help. They view recruitment, because recruitment usually has the last voice in the RFP bid. Recruitment usually is not the central risk that is being mitigated. When other things are on fire, that gets focused on. When recruitment's on fire, we'll let it burn. there's a little bit of a deprioritization of recruitment, and it makes sense. But in terms of standing out, like you mentioned, it really comes down to advocacy and adaptive workflow. So making sure that your advocacy approach is comprehensive and fits for your study. That's really what resonates with our clients, as well as making sure that our workflow makes sense for that specific study. If we're doing a GI and flare, you know, study, you know, should we be sending patients that aren't in flare to the site now? Or should we have an adaptive workflow where our team has a touch point and then sends the sites, you know, the patient when the patient, you know, should be sent to the site? And so I think it's a combination of, like, helping solve their specific project problems, as well as a comprehensive advocacy, and this, you know, we're adding influencers to the mix too. And so we'll see how that picks things up. But
that influencer thing to me is very exciting. I do think that's the future. And I do think these influencers, I mean, look at other industries, right? They're just getting so much power. They literally have so much influence. They earn their name. I think they can drive recruitment in a virtual trial, or even a traditional trial. Where do you find these people? Like, you just Google? Is it as easy as Googling and Instagramming people?
Yeah, it's the next level of Google. Like, there's, like, searches for, you know, influencers that use these hashtags. You can use, you know, in a lot of cases, hashtags to really do a condition, figure out who's posting it the most, who has the most engagement. If there's any, you know, hashtags are kind of mocked, but they're actually quite helpful. When we start recruiting, it's also an adaptive partnership process. So we'll have a starting point, but we'll really invest in getting to know who's who in the community. And usually we're, you know, 2 or 3 degrees away from the people that are most helpful with our initial outreach. So we'll have a starting place from our initial research if we don't have the partners already, and then we'll kind of find our way. It's usually about we'll see a bump within 3 to 4 weeks in terms of our community that we're going to go with. And then once we recruit and see what's working, I'd say for some reason it takes like 4 or 5 months, but something starts to click 4 or 5 months into the campaign work, where we see different groups that are going to work best launch, and that ends up helping. So it's an adaptive process, but it starts with Googling and hashtags.
You got to start doing that. I'm just curious personally to see which if all of them are in there. The one that comes to mind is schizophrenia. We do a lot of schizophrenia study. Are there influencers for schizophrenia?
Yeah, we can talk offline. Okay. But yeah, I can help you. One that we really like, Mindstorm, Krissa Hickey, who I think she's out of the Midwest, and we partner with her a couple of times.
Wow.
There's some nuance to it. We'll take it offline because there are some things to navigate with your large mental
health. We will. I'm just impressed that you knew, like, right off the bat. I just pulled one out at random because it's what we do. But wow. And I picked, like, a hard one that's a little tough. So
yeah.
Who's your ideal client, like pharma or CRO? Like, who are you trying – who would you like to target? Like, who's your ideal client?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, we can adapt our model in different ways. I think when we're working with, so it's not necessarily size, but a client that gives us the full purview of what's going on. You know, we have a large pharma company that's actually brought us in, walked us through the protocol, explained, you know, what is the patient experience and who's really going to be willing to travel. And we can get kind of the nuances of what's going to make the study successful. That's when we're able to target the right partners. That comes across when we're working with, you know, advocacy. And so for us, it's really when there's a genuine interest in a partnership, that's usually when things go best. So we've had more success with, like, you know, mid-tier pharma than working through, you know, mid-tier pharma, mid-sized CROs. Those folks are usually, you know, they have to be collaborative, and so that happens pretty frequently with them. But that doesn't exclude, you know, large pharma, large CROs, sites. Sites can be tricky because it depends how much budget you get. And so we can usually say, hey, here's our full bag of tricks. You can do this one small thing from that bag of tricks. We like to be able to set the bar of expectations higher. With sites, it's definitely an exploration. Right. And so site level can be tough, but there are a few where we have successful partnerships. Budget seems to be the biggest issue with working directly with sites, though.
Right. I could see this being helpful in Alzheimer's studies. For a few of our sites.
Yeah, we're working directly with a few sites in Alzheimer's too. We can talk about it later. But
talk about a tough indication with influencers. I mean, wow, I don't think it could get tougher.
Yeah, that's a really tough community. So your older communities for, like, Alzheimer's and other CNS where someone is older, like a Parkinson's, you have your large advocacy groups that really cover those well, but have their own route that they want to put you into. And in the case of Alzheimer's, we've not found a lot of success working through large advocacy. You know, we really have to go to one-off influencers that tend to be nationwide and not as regionalized. So we have to go with a hybrid advocacy plus digital ad. So, like, we'll run advocacy campaigns, we'll look at the profile, then we'll try to get our digital ads, because we have technology, some geeky technology we have that tells Google to mimic finding advocacy patients with our digital ads. And so we'll take some approach like that. It's kind of the best we've got.
It's tough, but if you can solve just Alzheimer's alone is a $1 billion business right there, just recruiting for Alzheimer's, never mind all the other stuff you guys are doing.
Yeah, so it's an area we've actually, you know, we've done, I think, like 2 or 3 Alzheimer's studies and had some decent success. But it wasn't like those studies where things just, like, clicked the first time. There's, yeah, a lot of speed bumps to get Alzheimer's research done.
Yeah. Well, if someone wants to get a hold of you, I will have links in the show notes. But where, like, can they email you, or what can they do?
Yeah. You can email us at, you know, info@leadcure.com if you want to speak to us, whether it's on the sales end, advocacy end, you know, interest in a role, whatever it might be. And then, yeah, social media at LeapCure on Twitter and Instagram.
I'll follow you guys right now on the LeapCure on Instagram. So very good. I'll have links underneath the video and underneath the show notes for the podcast. Thank you so much, Zach. I mean, this was a really good interview. I got to ask a lot of questions. I knew somebody was working with influencers out there. It just had to have happened.
Yeah.
And glad to meet you. Are you going to be at Bio this year in San Diego?
That's the plan. Yeah.
I'll be there. I'll see you there. If we don't meet prior to that, I'll look for you guys out there.
Yeah, sounds good.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for watching and listening, and catch you all later. Bye-bye. So, hey, everybody, thank you very much for listening to another episode of Random Musings from the Clinical Trials Guru. Again, if you haven't already, make sure you subscribe to this podcast. Make sure you leave a review, if you could be so kind, please. And also go to theclinicaltrialsguru.com if you're interested in learning more about who I am, who some of my guests are. You can have access to some of my YouTube videos. I do a lot of videos about clinical research. So go to theclinicaltrialsguru.com, and you can also call or text me anytime, 949-415-6256. Also follow me on any social media platform. It's Dan Svera. And you can also email me if you'd like, dan@theclinicaltrialsguru.com. Thank you very much.